Good morning. I'm Dennis Cunningham. This is Gordon Kaup. He wrote a brief in this case, but it's been bottled up with some brand new work, and so I'm going to argue the case. Mr. Cousins is also present in court. And we feel that we have been ill-served by the district court's decision to throw us out of court where we never got a chance to develop any kind of factual record, and where the court seems to have felt that or misconstrued the complaint.
Counsel, I have trouble with your argument regarding the immunities for purposes of the federal constitutional claims. Mm-hmm. However, I'm impressed with your argument under the Bain Act, the state statute. Under the Bain Act, I'm trying to figure out what your theory is. It looked as though the theory was that the state should have developed a system for letting people out once there's a change in the law that would entitle them to be let out. The theory that interested me more, frankly, it seemed more plausible, was once this fellow filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, that should have tipped the Attorney General off to look at the law instead of opposing it and decide, my gosh, he's right, we better let him out. I did not see that last theory laid out in your complaint. Is it?
The notice to the Attorney General that he deserved to be released would have come from his habeas petition?
Yes.
I think that's certainly true, Judge. I think it's belated at that point because, as you could see, the Attorney General didn't get around to making his informal response to the habeas petition for 14 months after it was filed.
How long was it between when Cousins served his habeas petition and the Attorney General's office confessed error and let him out?
I think it was another 3 or 4 months. An informal response apparently was invited. I think that's the process that they use. And in that, the Attorney General said, no, he should be kept in. The sentence is still good against him, even though the statute was overturned in the other case. Then the court issued an order to show cause, and at that point, the state agreed that the writ should lie, and he was released.
I want to follow up, if I may, on Judge Kleinfeld's issue on the Bain Act. What I'm troubled about with your Bain Act claim is this. Under the Act, as you know, you have to show that there were threats, intimidation, or coercion.
Mm-hmm.
What were those specific acts?
I think the coercion is merely it's a reverse thing, Judge, and I appreciate the difficulty or conceptual problem on the surface of the language. The coercion is keeping them in jail.
Are there any cases in California or otherwise you're aware of that have found threats, intimidation, or coercion to exist in a situation anywhere close to this?
No.
I didn't think so.
We didn't find it.
So under the circumstances, since and I'm kind of interested also, do you know of any cases moving over the 1983 portion of it and putting aside for a moment the immunity, are there any cases that you're aware of under federal or California law that indicate that there is a duty on the part of the state or its officials to respond in the way that you have alleged in this complaint?
I think the whole structure of these cases says that. There's nothing directly on point,
right,
in the sense
so
that
what
where it's, yeah, it has to come from them rather than from the prison.
You're asking us to make new law.
I don't think so, Judge, because
where's the case that already made the law?
All these cases that are about the essential law is that he's entitled to his release, and it's a violation of his rights to hold him without authority. So then the question is, and the immunity question is the same thing. were they responsible to understand that they had to do it in this instance, that they had to follow up, that there had to be action once the statute was stricken? And we think the strongest point is the fact of this scheme that's reflected in the regulations,
but the
of
regulations,
checking on all this stuff.
But the regulations are not a constitutional right. Are you suggesting?
I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, Case versus Kitsap County Sheriff's Department, quoting Gardner versus Howard, pretty well shoots CDCR case out, doesn't it?
I don't think we're saying that because they violated, we didn't even saying that they violated the regulations. They didn't do anything. So the point is there was a scheme.
Just to be sure we understand each other, that your client was done a wrong, I don't think anybody could logically contest. The question here is you've got officials of the state, and you are saying that there is a duty,
yes,
a legal duty,
yes,
that exists,
yes,
to get this man out,
yes,
to recognize that. And not only are you saying it's a duty, you're saying it is a constitutional duty,
yes,
specifically under the 8th and the 14th Amendment. So I think you agree there's no case law
that
says that you're right.
I'm going to be dragged kicking and screaming to that conclusion because I think that
the
import
case
of these cases.
What's the closest case?
I think the Haygood and the Alexander case articulate the right in such a way as and the responsibility of dealing with the circumstances. But
doesn't the Vandekamp case that the Supreme Court recently decided pretty much shoot a few big holes in the constitutional aspect?
Tell me what it said. I'm not.
This is the one where they framed the guy for murder, basically,
yeah,
and the Supreme Court said, well, they still got immunity.
Uh-huh.
This is a former DA of L.A. County, and I guess he was later Attorney General.
Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that in the sense that I think that the Bureau or the Corrections Department got this whole bureaucracy that deals with this exact question. It's
Counsel,
not specified.
I just don't follow it.
Wow.
It seems to me that maybe I misunderstand your argument. I just don't follow it if it's what I understand it to be. I think what you're saying is that there's a constitutional duty incumbent upon a state government to maintain a database so that whenever the state Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court or other authoritative tribunal decides that some law is invalid for one reason or another, they run a sort, the way you might to pick stocks with a price-earnings ratio, run a sort to find all prisoners who are imprisoned pursuant to that law in order to take the initiative in releasing them from their imprisonment. Is that a correct understanding
that
of what
it's
the duty is?
It's pretty close to that. I think it's pretty close to that because it seems to me absolutely logical that here the Attorney General has the other case. He loses. Okay, we got a statute stricken down. We know we've got some people convicted under this statute. We've got to act to get them released. That's
nice idea, but
But there's
constitutional
never been
any
need.
Case that said that, is there?
I don't think so. I don't know that the case has arisen. I'm sure we would have found it.
Suggesting this is a novel factual situation?
Yeah, but within the circumstance that's contemplated by the establishment of this bureaucracy to be sure of outdates and to make adjustments. I mean, all the language in those regulations, plus the statute that tells the Attorney General what he's got to do, says It's on you. There are these other cases, Haygood and Alexander, the prisoner, made the initiative.
How would your constitutional argument go if the statute upon which your client was convicted was overturned at one level, but then they appealed? Would he still be entitled to get out then?
He might be entitled to an order. I'm not sure about that, Judge, because I don't think it would be a final determination if an appeal was filed. He doesn't, Cousins doesn't assert that his right arose until the Supreme Court or the appellate court decision in North was final, mm-hmm. and the time to appeal it had expired. So, and I think that's the way it would operate. If there was an appeal, then you have to wait and see how the appeal turned out. If there wasn't, then he's got to be
The reality is that you're asking us to create a constitutional right out of whole cloth. Isn't that correct?
I don't believe it's right.
Well, it's not.
That,
you've conceded there's no case that says that there is. Wouldn't it be better, wouldn't help your client necessarily, but wouldn't it be better for the legislature, federal or state, to have hearings, determine the bases on which this would occur and what would need to be done to
Why would that be necessary? It's cut and dried. He's entitled to his release. They have, every day there's guys, men and women, coming to work in both offices. The supervisor says, wow, we've got a case where we had a statute overturned. Better call the department, let them know this statute is no good. Anybody you're holding, you need to notify the courts.
Well, the reality is that there are, sadly, there are instances where people are wrongly convicted or held too long, and what frequently happens is that the legislature or the city council or whatever pass an ordinance, a bill, and they recompense. I mean, nobody can completely make up for that lost time, but they pay people who have been damaged for that because they feel that as a matter of justice, they should do that. And maybe you have a remedy there. But the problem, at least that I'm struggling with, is the fact that in order to be successful on this, you have to show that there is a constitutional right. There's clearly no right under our case law based upon the manual on the administrative rules. That's already been decided. So you've got to show there's a constitutional right. The dimensions of that right, you agree, are amorphous. I mean, you just create this thing and it just kind of grows of its own. And I'm puzzled as to how that would be delimited. How do you cabin the thing once you start? I mean, what are the factual circumstances where the amendment, the Eighth Amendment, for example, the 14th Amendment, where does it arise? Where does it end? Who can take advantage of it?
I don't think you have to go beyond the circumstances of the case, Judge, in the context of the right that not to be wrongfully imprisoned, not to be imprisoned without a basis. I'd rather sit down for a minute and see what counsel
Please
has
do.
To say about that
Please do.
And get up for a last word.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. Will Fong, Deputy Attorney General for the State of California, appearing on behalf of the defendants' appellees.
Help me on something distinct from the constitutional argument. I'm interested in state law claims. If I recall correctly, a 12b-6 dismissal has to be based not only on the pleading not stating a claim, but no claim could be stated upon which relief could be granted under the facts alleged. I can't remember the exact words. It seems to me that he's got a possible Bain Act claim and a possible false imprisonment claim under state law. And since he's got a federal handle, there's no jurisdictional problem. And it troubled me that a man should spend a long time in prison when concededly the Attorney General conceded that he was entitled to be out of prison. So we did some independent research in Chambers, and there's this California Supreme Court case, Sullivan versus County of Los Angeles, that says no immunity, the sheriff is liable under the California Tort Claims Act, where because of basically a superior court failing, the man who was supposed to be let out of jail was not let out of jail for a few days. Days in that case, not weeks or months, as in this one. I don't understand what's the matter with a state law claim. The federal immunities don't matter.
Correct.
The constitutional claims get the constitutional immunities, and after Goldstein, I don't know what a prosecutor can possibly have personal responsibility for. But the state law claims, those federal constitutional immunities just don't matter. And under this California case in Sullivan, they're not there. There aren't any.
I agree, Your Honor. We did not assert an immunity argument to the state Bain Act claim. What we tried to present was that with respect to these individual defendants named in this lawsuit, Lockyer, former CDCR.
He sued the Attorney General's office, didn't he?
Not in this action. Procedurally, the state may have been a defendant, but when I got the file, the only defendants in the case were the individually named defendants.
I'm looking at Lockyer on here.
Correct.
That's the AG.
He sued in his individual capacity.
Let me tell you why I asked that question. I was unimpressed with plaintiff's argument that they should have figured it out after the state court said that the law that he was imprisoned under was unconstitutionally vague. I don't see the practicality of that. But once he filed a habeas petition, then, yeah, they should have figured it out. I mean, if you're a lawyer on the defense, you get the petition, and it turns out you're supposed to research it. And if the guy's right, you do something about it. You let him out in this case. And once they got his habeas petition, they didn't. They fought him until the California Supreme Court, I think it was, issued an order to show cause. What excuse do you have for fighting this and not letting him out? And they said, well, we don't have any, actually.
I would offer this, Your Honors. I understand it procedurally. When the habeas was filed, I believe it was the county district attorney's office that responded to that habeas, not the attorney general's office. And I'll stand corrected if counsel corrects me. But my understanding was that was the situation. And when the file then got to the attorney general's office, it was reviewed. And there is some analysis that goes into the statute, the penal code statute that was overturned, and there was some thinking that although in the North case that penal code statute was found to be unconstitutionally vague in a certain respect, that that may not have applied to Mr. Cousins' case. So there was an analysis on that.
They ultimately conceded that it did, right?
But at some point it was decided not to challenge. But again, my understanding is that there was the initial.
I had this right. He was charged with not reporting as a sex offender. He'd been sleeping in his car parked in front of the Salvation Army. And then when somebody else got his spot, he parked his car down the street and got busted for not reporting the change of address from where his car was.
There were some issues to the distance where he had informed the authorities that this is where his vehicle
was. Is that what happened, the facts that I described?
As I understand it, yes, Your Honor.
And it was a question of whether it's more than 50 feet or 50 yards or something?
Something, or maybe 100 feet, some 100 yards, something like
maybe
that.
Maybe 100 feet?
Yes. But that was the crux of the reason.
I suppose he could amend his complaint. Rule 12 would not allow dismissal if it was amendable to charge the right person, whether it's the county DA or an assistant DA or the AG or an assistant AG or whoever decided to fight him on this.
Well, let me respond to that, Your Honor. That's certainly true that he can amend, but our position would be that under the facts of this case, there would not be an ability to amend under any circumstances of facts, as we know them to apply to this case, that would allow them to state a valid Bain Act claim.
Well, it looks like they don't have any immunity under state law.
Correct.
So what justification was there for fighting them on this?
As I understand it, again, it was a question of the applicability of the particular subdivision section under Penal Code Section 290. I believe it was F1. That was found to be unconstitutionally vague. But again, there was some analysis put into this matter in the habeas petition as to whether or not under Mr. Cousins' situation that may have been an exception or that the unconstitutional aspect was
that even though in the case the court had decided they said the law is unconstitutionally vague, was that a facial challenge incidentally?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was that a facial challenge where the California court decided the statute was unconstitutionally vague?
In the North matter?
Yes.
I believe it was.
So it wouldn't really matter if his factual circumstances were different.
Well, I'm at a little disadvantage to try to justify the analysis that went into the habeas petition because I wasn't part of that and I don't have all the details.
It would be kind of amazing, actually, if after on a facial challenge the law was held unconstitutional. Nevertheless, the idea was this individual should have known that he had to report a change of address when he moved the car that he slept in because his spot was filled 100 feet down the road.
Yeah, I can offer this, Your Honor. My understanding is that there may have been other subdivisions of Penal Code Section 290 that may have applied to Mr. Cousins' case, which would have been some basis for opposing the habeas.
If there's some justification for fighting the habeas, it would really be nice to know it now before we decide the case.
Well, ultimately the decision was made that the habeas would not be opposed, and therefore Mr. Cousins did secure his release.
I'd like to follow up on a tangent on the Bain Act issue. The statute itself requires that there be threats, intimidation, or coercion. I ask your opposing counsel the same question. And I, with respect to these same defendants as pleaded, is there a requirement under the Bain Act that there be specific pleading as to any, you know, basis on which there was threats, intimidation, or coercion?
I would certainly answer that with a yes, Your Honor, in the sense that the cases we were able to locate that address the Bain Act, the Angelucci case and the Austin case cited in our papers, do go to some length to explain very clearly that under the Bain Act, you do have to allege specific facts of the requisite acts required under that statute, which are either discrimination, threats, intimidation, or coercion.
Why isn't it coercion to lock a steel door and not let a guy out?
Certainly Mr. Cousins was incarcerated involuntarily. There's no question of that. And if
why isn't that coercion?
Because the way
he would like to go out and go to McDonald's, but the door is locked and he can't get out. Why doesn't that coerce him to make him stay in his room?
The distinction I would make in this case, Your Honor, with respect to these three individual defendants is that at the time Mr. Cousins was in prison and the North ruling came in to invalidate Penal Code Section 290, Subdivision F, I believe, Mr. Cousins was still incarcerated under legal process. So it was a court order, a judgment, a sentence from the court authorizing his confinement at Mule Creek State Prison or within the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. There's no act undertaken by former Attorney General Lockyer or former Director Rimmer or former Warden Campbell that coerced Mr. Cousins' stay in prison, because at that time it was under legal process. This is not a case where these individuals knew that he should not have been in and either did something or failed to do something they should have to keep him in longer.
That lends two different issues. One is whether there's coercion, and the other is whether they should have known better. It seems to me that on the whether they should have known better, you've got a very distinct argument from whether there's coercion. I still don't understand why it isn't coercive to lock a guy up.
Well, I would offer the context of the cases that do specifically address the Bain Act. You know, the California Supreme Court in the Angelucci matter addressed that issue. And whether it's Angelucci or Austin that we're talking about, these are always cases where the defendant or the defendant in the civil case undertakes some action that either pressures or threatens with violence or intimidates the plaintiff.
Well, true. Usually, people trying to coerce haven't been as successful as to have somebody locked in a cell. But once you have him locked in a cell, you don't have to threaten him anymore. You've got him.
Well, if any of the named defendants had caused Mr. Cousins to be placed into the cell and have the door locked when they should not have done so, then arguably that's coercion resulting in Mr. Cousins losing the exercise of his right to not be locked up. In this case, we have defendants who are heads of either agencies, departments, or prisons who have no knowledge of Mr. Cousins, who at the time of the North decision.
The knowledge thing, I think you're really strong on. I'm thinking if, oh, say when, what was it, Lawrence, consensual homosexual conduct is constitutionally protected, there are probably some people doing time in various jails around the country for that. And if they said, hey, let me out, the Supreme Court has just decided the Lawrence case, my guess is that the jailers would have said, well, you know, I don't really keep up on my slip sheets all that well. Why don't you file something and some of these lawyers who do keep up on the slip sheets can respond. I wouldn't have a problem with that part of your argument. I think you're right. But the part of the argument I have trouble with is once the lawyers do get it, once he files his petition, at that point, I just don't understand why keeping him locked up in a cell isn't coercive. What's more, under that Sullivan case, I don't think he even needs a Bain Act claim. And remember, this is 12b-6. He's also got a false imprisonment claim under California law. False imprisonment would appear to be independent of
Did he plead a false imprisonment?
I apologize, and I don't believe that he pled false imprisonment.
So we're not really dealing with false imprisonment here, are we?
Yeah, I don't believe that's an issue that was pled and
can I refer you to the actual language of the Bain Act, California Civil Code Section 52.1. It indicates that this gentleman can have an action against, in quotes, a person who interferes by threats, intimidation, or coercion with the exercise or enjoyment of another individual's constitutional or other legal rights. Now, other legal rights in this case, I think the government has stipulated that at a certain point he was entitled to get out of jail. Is that a legal right that he was entitled to get out of jail?
Arguably, certainly had a legal right to be released at the moment in time that the North decision came down.
If that's correct, why isn't Judge Kleinfeld's analysis about the coercion correct for purposes of the Bain Act?
My response would be, Your Honor, that if you analyze it in that fashion, that would result in sort of an instantaneous right that the incarcerated prisoner has. That once the decision is handed down from the Court of Appeals, I therefore have this right. The door to my cell should be unlocked, and I should now leave.
Let's just say that you allow a brief administrative period, a day or two, whatever, something like that. But in this case, you're talking about, I think, 3 months, and there was some active fighting against that. Why does that not qualify if you treat that as coercion, keeping him behind bars as a violation of the Bain Act?
Just to be clear, I believe if we're talking about this issue, we're only talking about it as it may apply to one of the defendants, former Attorney General Lockyer, because as it stands, the CDCR director and the prison warden would have no role in directly opposing the writ petition in a proceeding.
So you're saying that only one person was even in the line of authority there, right?
It seems so to me, Your Honor, and I would submit that if you're allowing some time for the Attorney General to become aware of the situation, to look at the legal issues, to analyze it, to determine applicability, and you're not requiring the instantaneous unlocking of the prison door, then it begs the question, how much time is permitted, under what circumstances, and does the Attorney General have the ability to analyze?
Why would not the corrected thing to do in this part of the case be to certify the question of the California Supreme Court? This is a matter of state law. We can construe it, but it is a matter of state law. Seems not to have been construed in a context similar to this. Why would that not be the appropriate thing to do?
Well, I'm not prepared to say that that's not the appropriate thing to do, Your Honor. My response would be that in the context of this specific litigation, we're not talking about a general right of Mr. Cousins to file a Bain Act claim against some state employee. We're talking about his ability to pursue that claim against these specific named individual defendants. And again, as I tried to articulate in the written papers, there are no set of facts, I believe, that would allow that claim to go forward against the former Attorney General, the CDCR director, and the prison warden.
How long was he held in prison subsequent to his petition for writ of habeas corpus?
from the moment of filing until the moment of release, I believe it is alleged to be 17 months. But I don't know.
So he did 17 months of prison after filing a correct petition?
Well, if you give me one moment, Your Honor, let me see if I have that specifically noted. One year and 7 months after North was decided is when Mr. Cousins was released.
So that would be 19 months.
19 months, yes.
So he did 19 months of imprisonment after filing a petition that was correct.
Correct, but critically, we're not talking about 19 months after a court had ordered his release and anyone failed to release
him. I'm talking about the petition.
As alleged, yes.
And during that 19 months, I gather for a while the Attorney General's office was handling the case, and for a while the County Attorney's office was handling the case. Mm. Do you know which individuals when? And who did what? Is it clear?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. And even at this point, it's not clear to me whether or not the habeas petition was handled entirely by the district attorney's office, such that when the order to show cause was issued, they did not appear, and therefore the
Where we are is he did 17 months of prison that he shouldn't have done after he told the state, you have to be letting me out under this Nord case. And we don't know who's responsible.
I can't disagree with anything that you said, Your Honor, but I would offer that there is a distinction between the right that you get once there's a legal change in the law and the process that may be required following that for you to ultimately reap the rewards or the benefits of that.
Frankly, right. What I'm thinking about is actually bad faith litigation and insurance claims. I don't know if you have familiarity with bad faith litigation.
In concept.
The idea is the insurance company doesn't have any right to go out and check with its policyholders all the time. You happen to have any problems that we haven't taken proper care of? But once the policyholder turns something over to the insurance company, like some medicals that it's supposed to pay or liability claim it's supposed to defend, if it just messes around and doesn't do anything, then it's subject to damages, which are not controlled by its policy limit, plus punitive damages for bad faith. And it strikes me as sort of an analogy here that even though I'm skeptical of the plaintiff's claim that the whole state apparatus has to be looking out, looking at the slip sheets and checking to see whether they have any prisoners entitled to relief, It looks more like an insurance bad faith situation once he's told them he's filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
I can't concede that point as with respect to former Attorney General Locke, Your Honor. I would like to take one step back, though, and say that
I guess we would have to know the whole internal system of the Attorney General's office to know if Lockyer is personally responsible or not. And to know who did what when and who has what responsibilities. For all we know, some assistant AG sent a report upstairs saying we ought to let this guy out. And his boss said, I don't think we dare do that without Lockyer's approval. And then Lockyer said, I'm not letting anyone out until the court said to. I mean, that's just speculation. I'm making it up.
Sure.
We have no idea what happened.
Sure.
Is that right or do we?
What I understand to be the case is that there was never any information conveyed to Attorney General Lockyer that we have one or more individuals, let alone Mr. Cousin.
That one way or the other from the record?
That's not in the record because we were dealing with the allegations in the First Amendment complaint.
So for all we know from the record on the 12B6, it was Lockyer's personal decision.
Well, if we assume that to be the case, Your Honor, the one step I wanted to take backwards was that when we talked about immunity application, certainly the state prosecutorial immunity cited in our papers would apply to Attorney General.
Well, that's only federal. That doesn't apply to the Bain Act, though.
No, that would apply to the state because this is a state law prosecutorial immunity that's separate and distinct from the federal immunity.
I don't know if there are any immunities under state law on account of the Sullivan case.
Hold on, let me.
What statute are you referring to, counsel?
Give me one second, Your Honor. This would be argument three in our appellee's brief on beginning on page 15. I'm sorry, this is beginning on page 17, the state claim prosecutorial immunity under government code section, California government code section
821.6.
821.6, which is a specific prosecutorial immunity for state law claims, which would apply to the Bain Act.
You're saying that notwithstanding the fact that there is no, in effect, 1983 prosecutorial immunity, there is separate California state law immunity, so that even if a cause of action were pleaded under the Bain Act, there would still be no liability.
Correct. If the targeted defendant is part of the Attorney General's criminal division handling the criminal appeals, then this 821.6 section would apply.
I don't understand how you make an argument out of that. For one thing, you've got Sullivan that seems to say no immunities. For another thing, the words of 821.6 don't seem to fit, unless I've missed something. It says a public employee is not liable for injury caused by his instituting or prosecuting any judicial or administrative proceeding within the scope of his employment, even if he acts maliciously and without probable cause. My problem there is that this wrongfully imprisoned fellow, what's his name again? Cousins.
Yes.
He's not saying the DA shouldn't have prosecuted me. He's not saying the DA shouldn't have instituted a prosecution against me. He's not going on instituting or prosecuting. His claim is they shouldn't have defended against my prosecution of a claim. And 821.6 just creates a shield for instituting or prosecuting. It doesn't create a shield for doing anything at all.
Your Honor, I would direct the Court's attention to the Ingram versus Flippo case cited in our papers on page 17, which offers some guidance on the scope of the immunity. And that case does stand for the proposition that the immunity under 821.6 is to be given an expansive interpretation, and it does apply to both pre- and post-conviction conduct by the state prosecutor. In other words, if you...
What's the name of the case? Ingram?
Ingram, I-N-G-R-A-M, versus Flippo, F-L-I-P-P-O.
I see your cite.
Yes.
I don't happen to have the case handy, and I haven't read it. I see it's a Cal-App case.
Yep.
Pre- and post-conviction conduct. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's what kind of conduct was there. What did the
I apologize, Your Honor. I can't. The specific facts of the case escape me at the moment. The point I was trying to make with the citation of that case is that this does cover both the prosecutorial instituting.
I don't know what it covers because I don't know the facts and don't know exactly what it said. So I'd appreciate your help, but. What were the facts of the case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't recall the facts of the Ingram case. Cited. I apologize for that.
Well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel?
I can't tell you what Ingram versus Flippo says either. Right? I know we got it in a pile here, and I looked at it quickly, but I don't remember the precise facts. But I do believe that the immunity in 821.6 is limited to, it would in this case have been limited to the North case. It's not limited to a collateral case where the duty that we're trying to impose here is ministerial.
Also, what you're saying is that under Ingram v. Flippo, if it had still been State of California versus Cousins, everything would be immune. But this isn't State of California versus Cousins. This is a different case.
In terms of that immunity that would apply to the initiation of a prosecution, the Attorney General is not involved in the prosecution of Cousins. He's only involved in learning that the statute Cousins is held on is invalid, and he's entitled to release.
But isn't that statute intended to be the state equivalent of the qualified complete immunity that the federal government has?
I would say immunity, and yeah. I don't think that applies here either. I don't think it's qualified immunity.
We understand that the federal absolute and qualified immunity doesn't apply. I'm saying, isn't 821.6 intended to be the state equivalent of that?
of Imler, of prosecutorial
right.
immunity, yes, but not of qualified immunity.
Okay, and, so you're saying it's only absolute immunity
right.
then.
And okay. and let's don't forget here, we sued these three people because we knew who they were. We didn't expect them to be the ultimate defendants. We expected to have discovery. And this goes to the whole issue here of whether there should be qualified immunity in the failure to take steps to release him or to find out that he was entitled to release, because we never got any discovery, so we don't know how that system works. The Attorney General may have a person that absolutely keeps track of such an event in the law, that a statute is overturned. I don't think it happens that often, Judge. You don't have to read the advance sheets every day. It's a sex offender case. It probably was in the newspaper when the statute was invalidated. I mean, there's a million ways that notice can come, and they have this whole elaborate system of keeping track of it, and they do read the advance sheets. If you read the regulations as not applying to any specific situation, applying only to the authority to continue to hold a prisoner and when it expires, and keeping track of that and making sure that any other activity in the law that applies is brought to bear. So, without any discovery, we never got to find out anything about how that works in the department or in the Attorney General's office, and we were cut off at the knees. We never found out who the responsible party
is. That, of course, is one of the reasons for we deal with the Pearson case now a lot, because
yes.
they don't want these government officials to have to undergo discovery because of all of the costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, unless a prima facie case is stated. So,
Judge, not to cut you off, but the cases are careful to say mm-hmm. how difficult it is to grant qualified immunity at the pleading stage because you have no facts in the record to...
I guess there's immunity from trial and immunity from liability. The federal immunity is immunity from trial.
Yes. Sometimes it's immunity from discovery, but only in a proper case.
States 21.6, immunity from damages, or is it immunity from litigation and trial?
It strikes me by its language that it's immunity from the cause of action. If
it's talking about initiating the prosecution, then but it's the prosecution and it's not the administration. Judge, I want to point out that in the complaint we did have a false arrest claim. We also
it's
had
not
a
liable for injury, so I guess that would be damages, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So you're saying you did have a false?
There is a false arrest claim in count 4 and ER 20 in the amended complaint. We also originally had a complaint against the entity. I'm not sure exactly what happened to it, because under 815.6.
What page of the first amended complaint is your?
I'm sorry?
I'm looking here now at the first amended complaint. What
on the page of the complaint is page 7, ER 20 down in the lower
right.
Oh,
so you've got a false arrest and false imprisonment.
Yes,
down.
We do. Yes, we do. I mean, that doesn't make me want to give up. I'm very encouraged by what Your Honor say about the state claims, but it doesn't make me want to give up the qualified immunity argument, because it seems to me they have notice based on the structure that they have and the operations that they carry out normally. They have an obligation on the Attorney General under Section 12512 of the Government Code that he shall direct the issuing of such processes may be necessary to carry a judgment into execution. I don't know why that wouldn't apply to a collateral matter as well as a direct matter.
We're way over time. But
I understand, Judge, but you did go over.
ER 20, that's very important.
Thank you. It's most important to us that we come out here with some kind of case, but I urge Your Honors to look carefully at the qualified immunity question at this stage with this much evidence on the face of it, or this much pleading to the effect that they did have a form of operations which would have given them notice of their obligation in such a case. They did have, in the Attorney General's office, the need to communicate
with others. There's still a puzzle I have about this. You keep arguing your hard case instead of your easy case.
Yeah, I know.
You keep arguing your hard case about some big system. And
I
frankly focus more on the easy case for Cousins. The guy was in prison for 19 months when he shouldn't have been. And I don't. I'm afraid there's something I'm missing. And what I think is the easy case is not so easy, and you need the hard case. How come you're not focusing on just Cousins doing 19 months after he petitioned?
Well, that's the only thing we're here about. I mean, maybe just because of the problem of the interpretation of coercion in the Bain Act. You know, okay, now we got the false arrest case, but this is not about an arrest.
Am I missing something here?
I think what you're missing, Judge, is the notion that there was a clearly established right here, and that in the cases such as Haygood and Alexander, where the prisoner was bugging the authorities to get out, it activates the same process, the same obligation. Find out the circumstance as to whether there's still a legal basis to hold the prisoner.
Did the trial court sustain a 12b-6 motion against the false imprisonment claim?
I don't think she touched it.
Didn't even touch it?
I don't know. I don't think
so. What happened to it? I mean, is that just lying there in co-ed or something?
The case was dismissed.
Yeah. So
she didn't say anything about it.
By implication, she did rely on it.
Yeah. She said can't. There's no remedy for this man for the 19 months.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
She dismissed it, didn't she?
Yes.
She dismissed it.
Yeah. There's a judgment of dismissal. We're appealing.
Is there any problem that you're aware of if we were to reverse and send it back for the false imprisonment, just arguendo? Would you have any problem going forward with that? Are there any problems in pleading or otherwise you're aware of that would create issues for you?
I can't think of anything offhand, Judge.
I know what you want.
Litigating in the federal court and dealing with federal civil rights, and I think that's what's at stake here. But I think that the ancillary rights under state law are
constitutional thing. You know, I can see it in California. They've got such a gigantic bureaucracy anyway that having another 15 or 20 lawyers going through a database, maybe they can afford that. I don't know. But Alaska, they probably have one lawyer in Alaska. Who has some responsibility?
How do they have so many lawyers doing it, Judge? How many? You talked about searching a database, okay? Convictions under 290. It's been thrown out. How many people do we have that we're holding under that? Who are they?
I'm thinking if we created your constitutional right, Alaska would have to first create a database. They would have to hire people to create a database, maybe a year and a half to figure out how to do it. And then it would have to hire some lawyers to figure out how to do the coding and read the slip sheets and figure out what commands to send to the database.
No way, Judge. They would say the Attorney General, when a statute is ruled unconstitutional, you know there are some people been convicted under it. Just find out who they are and let them out. It doesn't take that much. And certainly in Alaska, they don't have hundreds of thousands.
How do I find out who they are? How do I even know if there's a case unless I keep up on a
slip sheet? What if you put out a notice to everybody in the prisons and say, if you're under 290, get in touch with us and we'll, because you're entitled to get out? What's so hard about that?
Got it, I guess. Thanks.
You know, all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Cousins versus Lockyer is submitted.